Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM.
WMTB LP St. Petersburg.
Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
Mark Arelli has forged a colorful career by making the art of being everywhere all the time seem effortless. A virtual Swiss Army knife of musical ability, Mark is equally at home serving as a sideman for Grammy-winning artists like Paula Cole, Mark Cohn, and Josh Ritter, or producing albums for Laurie McKenna, as he is for writing and producing his own material. He's also a multi-instrumentalist. His song, By Degrees, was nominated for Song of the Year at the 2019 Americana Music Awards. A product of the New England music scene, Mark now tours extensively across the country, and we are honored to have him on Song Creating. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So you've been at this now for about, maybe 25 years professionally?
I think my debut on Signature Sounds came out in 99. So what's that, 23?
Yeah. But you were hustling before then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've been hustling since I can't remember when.
So as you've grown and you have a family, has your sound to me has been consistent in how mostly consistent, you know, there's always alterations, but have you felt differently how you approach a song or how you complete a song now as you've matured?
That's it's really fascinating to get your take on that, because I think the opinion I've heard more commonly throughout the years is just how stylistically diverse and varied I am, and I understand like where that comes from, but to me I don't really hear it. It all just sounds like me and whatever I'm interested in at a given point in time. So it's nice to know that at least one other person feels like it's been pretty consistent.
Well, you know, I just saw you the other night in concert, and I love the fact that you went from a rockin' tune to a very soft, you know, tune like Look Up. You know, I mean, there's no question there's a diversity in what you can perform, but there's a distinct Mark Arelli sound that I feel has been consistent. But thinking more about the songwriting, not so much as you, as the final sound of the song is, have you, I don't know if there are many people in your business who have been happily married for 20 years. And and does that color how you approach things? You know, is it harder to write a sad song? How do you delve into that?
Well, I do think that my personal life has definitely obviously affected, you know, my life as a writer and as an artist. I tend to look at my creative output personally in terms of big life events. So the stuff that I wrote and released before I was married kind of seemed to come from one stage of development and then another. You know, after I got married, there's kind of different songs. Certainly after I became a father, that really was a sea change in terms of what I was writing about and the stakes that I felt were involved in just songwriting and being a creative person in general. I do think that the personal stages of my life have affected the writing. I know that, for example, now it's really the editing is really a bigger part of the process than maybe it was before. I think when you're younger, at least when I was younger, was always in a rush and always excited about the latest thing I wrote, and I was very, you know, quick to honor that excitement. It's not like I never edited anything, but it's new, it's exciting, it's moving me, it must be great, you know, and I would kind of follow it. And now when I write a song, you know, even if I get through it on that initial burst of inspiration, which is pretty rare, then, you know, after the fact, before I commit it to a record, you know, the knives really come out in a way that I don't think I was as courageous or as quick to do when I was younger.
Is there a group of people who you run these songs by that you trust for their opinion, or is it something that you find you do yourself?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think a lot of writers, and this is something that is actually not discussed very openly, but I don't think there's any shame in it, but a lot of writers have, you know, first readers or first listeners. You know, for years it was my wife, and she still hears stuff pretty early. But now I have like a variety of support for this sorts of things. I have my manager, who oftentimes, if I write a song and my wife's at work and I don't want to disturb her at work, I'll send it to my manager because her job is listening to my songs. So my manager helps, you know, trusted friends, like Laurie McKenna, Jeffrey Foucault have been really helpful in terms of, kind of gauging the emotional, truth of a song, or just getting really ruthless about the editing, and whether what I'm trying to express is actually being expressed in the most concise manner. So I've sent songs to those two in the past. And then every June I do a songwriting retreat up on 3 Mile Island in Lake Winnipesaukee. And that's with anywhere from 12 to 15 other artists that, sometimes we collaborate and write songs together, and other times, like with Dinty Child, who I know you've had on the podcast before, and other times I'm just writing songs by myself and I'm playing them for people after dinner every night at our kind of song circle share, and people are commenting on things that they like or maybe things that didn't quite land for them. So, yeah, I do have a community of people that I do lean on for kind of editorial feedback, because it can be really hard to kind of gauge that on your own.
Yeah. Is it more a critique of the lyrics or the music? Which is it that tends to be more that you're looking for?
Lyrics, usually. Not that I consider myself any kind of musical genius or anything, but I'm kind of working in pretty simple musical, with pretty simple musical vocabulary. I'm not using a ton of jazz, you know, voicings. And
I'm going to argue with you on that one, because after talking to Dinty, I dissected that look up a little bit. I think there's an augmented seventh chord in there somewhere.
That's true. Well, there is. There's some weird chords in there.
You all the credit.
Yeah, I did write most of the music for that one, but here's the thing. I don't actually know what those chords are named, and anytime I have to communicate them to another musician, it's incredibly stressful, because I have to like go to some app and like put dots on all the strings and the frets where I put my fingers and see what the name of the chord is, and then I see this long chord name and I'm like, "Oh, geez, it's like a triangle with that extra finger, you know, like is." So I definitely sometimes stray away from GCD kind of 1-4-5 things, but I don't necessarily know quite what I'm doing harmonically, but I can hear what I want to do harmonically and I can usually get there. But lyrically, I think I'm always looking for that sweet spot where you can't imagine communicating what you've communicated with any less, but that you haven't used any more than you possibly need to communicate that idea, you know. And if you listen to even songwriters like, you know, Tom Petty is kind of the perfect example of this. It's just utterly concise songwriting, and it sacrifices none of the catchiness, and none of the narrative meaning. In fact, the pithier and more concise it gets, sometimes it lets people inject some of their own kind of meaning and own interpretations a little bit more easily, and that, you know, I think makes the songs ultimately more interesting.
How autobiographical do you find your writing to be? We're talking about your song Mill Towns, which is certainly autobiographical about your relationship with Bill Morrissey. But you, at least your songs come across as autobiographical. And I'm thinking like A Man from Out of Town. And is it? Or are you really, you're just channeling other people here with that?
Well, A Man from Out of Town specifically is another Bill Morrissey song. So it's not autobiographical for me. I don't know if it was autobiographical for Bill, but I wouldn't have been surprised if it was. I do think that there's, the way that I've kind of thought about this over the years is, I mean, I can say they're autobiographical, but then I feel like sometimes that's giving me almost a little bit too much credit. I heard a really great quote when the feminist activist author Bell Hooks passed away. And I'm not sure if I can't, you know, I saw it on the internet, so either it's totally true or I can't 100% vouch for its provenance. But she was attributed to this quote that said something to the effect of, the job of art is not to present or describe life as it is. It's to imagine how life could be. And I just loved that quote because it really gets at my mindset when I'm writing, even songs that seem autobiographical. Like, I'm just not as good a person or as strong a person as the guy in my songs. That's the person I want to be. That's the one that I imagine I could be if I keep, you know, working on myself and holding myself accountable. But, you know, so they seem autobiographical, and they sort of are. But again, I think I don't quite in real life live up to the man in my songs, though that's a perennial goal, you know. So that's who I imagine I could be someday if I keep working at it.
So you have written a number of songs that have a social aspect to it, social commentary aspect to it. And is that something that has increased, taken, a more, is that a larger percentage of your songs since like the past 5 years, so to speak? Or have you always felt this way?
No, in fact, the last 5 years, which of course encompassed the administration of the person whose name I will never utter, I actually was far less socially conscious in my art, almost by design. I really found my voice in incorporating these sorts of, you know, quote unquote political opinions or storytelling in my songwriting during the Bush administration, the second one. Mm-hmm. That was the one where, you know, I was out of graduate school. I was a full-time musician. I really was kind of on my own for the first time in my life, and it was only then that I kind of realized the impact that quote unquote politics has on your actual life. And up until that point too, which, you know, I'm embarrassed to say, in 2001 I was 27. Yeah. So up until that point, I'd had a good childhood, and I kind of was raised by loving, caring adults, and I just kind of always thought that adults knew what was best and knew what was going on and had our best intent, our best, you know, the best things in mind. And then I saw the Bush administration and I thought, oh my God, these guys have, not only do they have absolutely no clue what is happening, but they are actively working against us and torturing in our name and doing all these horrible things. And that's when that stuff started to come into my songs. It wasn't a conscious choice. It just, I was just so worked up about it, and it was just such a foundational, it kind of mm-hmm. rocked me so much foundationally as a person, that I couldn't help but write about it. And, you know, looking back, it seems a bit naive, you know, like, yes, Virginia, you know, the politicians really may not always have your best interests at heart. But, you know, again, in my defense, I had grown up in a loving home, you know, in a Boston suburb. I had, my parents worked really hard to give me a great life. I have no complaints, and was really very fortunate. So as much as I tried to, you know, be empathetic and compassionate and open to the world around me, it wasn't until my mid-20s and the Bush administration when I really started to realize, like, oh, this not everything is not okay, and the adults do not know necessarily what is best or what is going on. So, you know, that was Hope and Other Casualties was the record that came out of that. And that was 2006. And then 2008 was when my first son was born. He was born in 2007. So Delivered was the record after, yeah, Hope and Other Casualties. Then there was a record of Lullabies, which was completely apolitical. Mm-hmm. And then Delivered was another intensely, I don't want to say political record, but there was just a lot of songs that examined the kind of world that I had brought this new soul into, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I tend to think about the political stuff or the socio-political stuff, and just in terms of like another part of the world that I'm looking at and examining in song. I'm not trying to change the way that anyone votes or, you know, solve any societal problem or anything. I don't think music can really do that. I think it can get people to think about things they hadn't thought about before, or maybe kind of help them realize that they're not alone and give them a little more fortification to work towards things that they're working to change, you know, in their own life. I'm kind of going off the rails here,
no,
Steve.
No, that's okay. This is fine. So I'm curious, and I don't want you to name any names, but do you find that there's anybody in the music circles that you associate with who actually do lean the other way? Because, I mean, folk singers are notoriously liberal Democrats. You know, again, I don't want you to name names, but have you found pushback very much?
Not from other artists per se. Occasionally I get a, you know, heated email or something. I think there was actually the one that I'm thinking of, was during the George W. Bush administration, where, I got a really kind of nasty email from a fan, and I was just like, sorry you feel that way, you know. I'm not ever trying to antagonize anyone, but I'm also, you know, I don't think I should be in the business of self-censorship. It was a non-apology kind of acknowledgement of his anger. And this guy actually, several months later, showed up at a gig of mine in Washington, D.C., and I was initially a little bit alarmed because he introduced himself after the gig as that guy who wrote the email, and I thought, oh, God, is this going to, what's going to happen here? And he actually reached out his hand and apologized and said that he had come around to my way of thinking. I don't think I had necessarily been the thing that changed his mind or anything. I think the world had kind of shown him more data in the time between that email and that concert. But as far as artists go, I don't know. I'm sure there are more conservative artists or you know, but I don't know of any. I mean, it's not really something I think about in terms of people's political views in their art. I wish there was more audience cross section. I know that I do have some conservative fans, and I'm grateful for that. I just wish that we were, you know, talking to each other a little bit more. I think that a lot of that has to do not necessarily with my particular politics, but just with the way that we find and consume music now. You know, when when Neil Young was starting out in the heyday, you know, how many radio stations, how many TV stations were there? You know, everyone heard Ohio. You know, now I don't know how many people have heard By Degrees, you know. But I know it's fewer. And you know, to the point of the audience cross section, I have gone to see Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and this was back after Neil Young released the Living with War record, and it had that the single from that was Let's Impeach the President, who was George W. Bush at the time, and they played that song, and the crowd, which was, you know, almost entirely consisted of former baby boomers and, you know, aging hippies, booed him. The guy that wrote Ohio, that they, you know, that they would have, you know, cheered on at, you know, all these counterculture events in the 60s and 70s, they booed him. So, you know, he had a, obviously had a much larger platform and a much wider cross section to his audience than I do now. But I do wish that there was more, you know, kind of back and forth between the people of different political persuasions through my music, you know, because I don't feel like I'm writing political music. I'm just writing things that are close to my heart, you know.
I think you're writing social justice music, maybe less than I hate the term political, because once you call something political, then it becomes political, and a lot of it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way.
And that's a really, politics are extremely boring. I mean, politics is basically just who's in power and what are they trying to do and get away with. You know, that's not, I'm not really that interested in that. I think social justice is, as you say, far more interesting and necessary.
Let's talk about Milltowns and your, more importantly, I think, I mean, the song is terrific, but your relationship with Bill Morrissey is unique, and obviously you're too young to have watched the show Kung Fu back in the day.
I did not get the reference.
But I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you met and how you developed your friendship and you know, go from there.
So Bill, I was aware of Bill's music growing up here in the greater Boston area, and as a folk music fan, I would get the standard, you know, wait until you get out into the real world, kid, you know, you'll see how good you had it. And so, you know, you hear that enough times and you think, well, where is this real world that people are referring to? And if you're in Boston, it's not to the east, because it's just the ocean. So, like so many young men before me, I would look west for the real world, and you know, sure enough, there was this great crop of Texas singer-songwriters that I kind of found in high school and just fell in love with. You know, your Guy Clarks, your Steve Earles, your Jimmy Dale Gilmore's, Joe Ely, you know, Butch Hancock, Towns Van Zandt, and you know, those to me were the guys that were the real songwriters writing about the real world, you know, out west. And you know, the guys like Bill, who were from New England and writing about New England mill towns and whatnot, that was like, that's not the real stuff, you know. But then I sent away from for a Robert Earl Keen record when I was in high school. In college, and it's called A Bigger Piece of Sky. And I remember the day it came. I opened up the envelope. I was all excited, and I looked on the cover, and there's like a painting of a cowboy on a horse. And I was like, "Yeah, this is the real world out west, right?" And I turn it over, and there's Robert Earl sitting in, you know, out in the chaparral in the high desert somewhere, in a Western pearl snap shirt. You know, a real man in the real world. But his shirt is unsnapped and he's wearing a t-shirt underneath. And I don't know how many other, I've never met anyone else that made this connection, but I made it immediately. I said, he's wearing a Bill Morrissey t-shirt. I didn't even know that New England folk singers had t-shirts in the early 90s, you know. So that was a real crystallizing moment for me. It kind of telegraphed to me that if the artists that I were idolizing as writing about the real world were in turn idolizing New England artists, then everything must be valid geography for, you know, American, you know, singer-songwriters to write about. So I really kind of redoubled, you know, my fandom of New England songwriters after that, you know, kind of revelation. And Bill Morrissey, you know, chief among them. I got to meet him when I opened up for him at the Iron Horse one night, and Cliff Eberhardt came to the show, who was a friend and a mutual friend, as in the Milltowns. The first line of Milltowns is, you know, "You were a legend when I met you, introduced by a mutual friend." That's mm-hmm. Cliff Eberhardt. And after the show, Cliff invited me back to his house where Bill was staying to hang out. And that was a very long, frankly, drunken, wonderful, semi-memorable night where we just, you know, goofed around and played, you know, songs of every stripe and every genre, and just got to know each other. And it felt like being kind of inducted into a secret society of sorts.
And you were how old at this time?
It's probably 2001 or so. So I was, that was probably, 27.
But what an amazing experience.
I never forgot it. Things, it didn't stay like that. Bill had a very well documented struggle with, alcohol, and, he kind of did a great job of undermining his own legacy in the years following that time. So there were, you know, there were the times that I saw him after that, sometimes years would pass, and years can be a lot of time in someone who's really struggling with substance abuse and alcohol, and you know, he just looked like a ghost kind of by the end of it. But he did go through several stints trying to beat his addiction, and the last time I saw him is the second half of Milltowns. You know, talking about autobiographical songs, Milltowns is one of the rare kind of fully autobiographical songs where it starts with an accounting of the night that I, you know, that night after I opened for Bill and met him for the first time, and we hung out and had a lot of fun, and then it ends with the last time I saw him. When, you know, he was trying to get back on his feet, and he had had a lot of hard living in between there. And, but, you know, the last time I saw him, we did a show together, as opposed to me opening for him. It was a shared bill. Mm. I still went first, of course. I wasn't going to follow one of my musical heroes, but, I remember he asked me, he said he'd heard that I'd covered his song Birches when he was in rehab, and as a, you know, a gesture of support. And he was like, you know, "You should sing it in your set." And I couldn't believe what he was asking me. It would be like Bob Dylan asking, you know, Bill Morrissey to play, you know, "Like a Rolling Stone," like, "You play it. I'm tired of it," you know. So I did, and we had a wonderful show, and I joined him for some of his set. And I remember standing with him outside on the sidewalk after the gig, you know, just saying like, "We should do that again. Like, yeah, we want to do more of this." And a quick handshake and off into the night, and that ended up being the last time I saw him.
Yeah, you've got a couple just terrific lines in here. Pulling on that bourbon is like Russian roulette. I mean, that's strong, and the visual of that is undeniable. I also love the in your refrain where the vacant storefront windows look like missing teeth. I mean, that's so strong. So a lot of your touring and your performing are in some of these small towns, and I almost wondered, it's almost like you did research on these mill towns, having not grown up in one, to really experience what they're like. And I guess you've seen your share of them at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I went to college in one. I went to college at Bates College, which is in Lewiston, Maine, which is not a small town. It's one of the largest cities in Maine, but it is a former mill town, and it has its more than its share of missing teeth, you know, darkened storefront windows. And I drive through a lot of those places. I don't play in a lot of those places because they tend not to have the resources to have the cultural infrastructure that, you know, brings in artists to perform live music, you know. But I drive through them a lot in my travels around the Northeast, and I always wonder, like, what are these folks' stories? How do people come to live here? How do they continue living here? There doesn't seem to be a lot of industry or work. You know, what are the stories here? So I wish I played in more mill towns than I actually do, but to me, they're emblematic of, you know, this whole kind of undercurrent narrative that, you know, is there if we care to pay attention to it and you know, put it into a song or a book or a short story.
I love watching some of these documentaries on PBS, you know, POV, and they really capture parts of America that I don't experience living in New England as much. And it seems like a lot of them do focus on the towns where the not a lot, but the ones I tend to gravitate to, the towns where the business has shut down, and you know, what are these people going to do? Whether it's a GM plant or just some small manufacturing facility that seems to have employed a lot of people, and boy, it's more common than it should be.
Yeah, and there's some real, like I was saying, there's some real human stories. There's a real human toll and a human consequence behind all of those things. My dad was a high school teacher, so I didn't grow up in the lap of luxury or anything, but he had a stable job, you know, and I never really worried about him losing his job as a teacher. Everybody had to go to school by law. So I figured, you know, his job was pretty safe. But, you know, for these manufacturing jobs, I mean, Boston is such a big player in the technology sector and the medical technology sector. Those are the kind of mills of, you know, yesteryear, like back in the 1800s, those mills, paper mills, you know, manufacturing mills, those would have been the big technology kind of the day, you know, the comparable thing. So if you go to a place like Haverhill, Mass now, man, back in the 1800s, that was a real city, you know, and now it's coming back a little bit, I guess. I haven't been there for a few years, but, it's not like it was at one time, you know.
Yeah.
And in the wake of that, there's a lot of stories, and I think that's where Bill Morrissey found a lot of his characters and a lot of his narratives. And it's something that I found, you know, pretty inspiring as well.
Did you begin considering writing this song after Bill passed away?
I mean, maybe I had been working on it unconsciously, you know, in all the time that I had known him, but it just came pouring out when he passed. Mm-hmm. I think, I can't remember exactly, but, you know, maybe a week or so after maybe not even a week or so after I heard the news. And it's one of those things, you know, where like you're sad, but it's not surprising.
Well, songs like this let people live on a little bit, and it's a tribute.
I hope so. That's my intention. Yeah. I mean, for all the struggling with alcohol and all the toll that can take on relationships, you know, my relationship with Bill was always very positive and very, very friendly. But my relationship was more through his music, you know. And the to me, the music, as much as I liked the man and thought he was, you know, a warm, funny friend, to me, the music is the real important part, and that's the stuff that's undeniable, you know. Other people might have had different experiences with Bill, and I understand and respect that as a person, but the music is there for everyone to enjoy, even people that didn't know Bill. And the music is undeniable. And I wanted, you know, my hope was that Mill Towns would have some of those same kind of undeniable, you know, reactions in people when they heard it, you know, like, that's a great line, that line about the missing teeth, or the bourbon and Russian roulette, you know. Because I would listen to his songs and have that reaction all the time. Oh, my God, that's an amazing turn of phrase. Oh, that's so true, you know. And so I wanted to kind of elicit that same reaction as an additional tribute to him, you know, in Mill Towns.
Did you do a lot of editing on this song? We were talking about editing before, and sometimes they just pour out.
Yeah, I think I might have sent this one to my friend Pete Nelson, who knew Bill very well, and I think he might have given me a few tips or a few suggestions. Honestly, it's pretty hazy, but I would have sent it to Pete just as like a, you know, as a courtesy, like, I wrote this about our friend, you know. Like, sometimes you don't want someone to hear that on the, you know, the radio, or be blindsided by it, you know, for the first time. So I kind of sent it around and let people know that I had written it. I don't remember there being a ton of editing, just maybe a line or two here and there, but sometimes that can have very profound implications for the song.
Yeah. All right, Mark, fill us in on what's coming up for you. You've got so many projects in the works. You're a pretty industrious guy.
Yeah. Well, I had to kind of chuckle a bit at your introduction there, you know, the mastering the art of being everywhere all the time. That's a very pre-pandemic way of you know,
present from your website.
Yeah. Well, that was probably the last time that I updated that thing. You know, honestly, now my job is to try and figure out what my job looks like now. I don't want to say I want to figure out how to get back to work, because I don't think there's anything back there. It's been a very transformational, very turbulent couple years for the artistic community. And I don't really think much of what used to be is there anymore. It's very mm-hmm. challenging. It was always very challenging, but I think it really helps me, at least, to think about things in terms of rebuilding. You know, it's like, it's not like we just evacuated this place and now we're going back to the place. The place is gone, and we have mm-hmm. to rebuild it in a better, more resilient way. I am returning to live performances, and trying to do that in a safe manner, where we, you know, where we are all taking care of each other and taking the necessary precautions. And, you know, I've also been working on music in my home studio here, and have actually finished another record. So that'll come out later this year. So I'm really looking forward to that.
That's great. Well, I'm lucky. I only have one album to count, and I haven't lost track.
There you go. Plenty of room for growth. Plenty of room for expansion.
It is fun. So we'll look forward to that next album and more shows. But I hope you stay well, stay healthy, and I look forward to seeing you again somewhere.
You as well, Steve. Thank you.
You can learn more about what Mark is up to and listen to songs from his new album, Blindsided, at his website, markarelli.com. And now let's hear Mark's song, Mill Towns.
You were a legend when I met you, introduced by a mutual friend. I laughed when you called me grasshopper, though I didn't know what it meant. We stayed up all night drinking, yeah, most of it is still a blur. But I remember picking along while you sang every song by Mississippi John Hurt. And the way you got so serious when you told me you invented the blues, and then you smiled in that way I could never tell if you didn't really think it was true. Now I'm driving through these mill towns down empty moonlit streets, where the vacant storefront windows look like missing teeth. They disappear into my rear view all along the rural route. And I pray for all that can't be rescued after everything goes. On a split bill up in Portland, I was getting ready to go on. You said grasshopper, you sang birches, I've been singing it for too long. So I sang it like I'd written it, though I wish you hadn't asked. Cause I couldn't shake the feeling like something was being passed. And you watched from behind the curtain, and I never will forget how you're pulling on that bourbon looks like Russian roulette. Now I'm driving through these mill towns down empty moonlit streets, where the vacant storefront windows look like missing teeth. They disappear into my rear view all along the rural route. And I pray for all that can't be rescued after everything goes
Thanks for listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM. To listen to more episodes, head over to songcreating.com. You can also find us on Amazon Music and Stitcher. And to check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart.